The next day, Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood around Moses from morning till evening. But Moses' father-in-law saw all that he was doing for the people. He said, "What is this that you're doing for the people? Why do you sit alone and all the people stand around you from morning till evening?"
It had been months since you had last laid eyes on your son-in-law. But even from afar, the stories carried on the wind, as it seems, reached your small village in Midian. You've been looking forward to the updates regarding those strange events, like water springing from rocks, or mysterious manna falling from heaven, or a sea split in two. You thought to yourself, God was doing wonders through this lowly shepherd that you've come to know. Having received word that Moses had camped at the foot of Sinai, you quickly packed things for your trip to meet Moses, to hear firsthand what those experiences were like. You decide that this would be a great time for a family reunion. So with Zipporah, Moses' wife, and Gershom, a name that announces Moses' conclusion of being a stranger in Midian, you call out to Eleazar. You think of the message that his name communicates. According to your son-in-law, the God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. You smile at the thought of it all. Now, with the family in tow, you make your way in the direction of God's man with haste. As you arrive, you notice the massive camp spread out across the wadi below the majestic mountain covered with smoke and cloud. It is here that you conclude that Moses was right, but before you could take it all in, you see him, and with a big smile, you walk toward him. Then in his humble way, he bows to the ground and rises and greets you with a kiss. Immediately, he takes you aside, his face worn but resolute, but there's a fire in his eyes. Not of anger, but of conviction, and he begins to recount everything that's happened. He tells you about the first time he walked into Pharaoh's palace, heart pounding, staff in hand, and how his words were met with mockery. "Let my people go," he had said, but Pharaoh only laughed. With every visit, Moses says that Pharaoh's heart grew harder, his pride taller than his pyramids. But then came the plagues, one after another, signs that Egypt's gods were powerless before the God of heaven. You listen in awe as he describes how the Nile turned to blood, how darkness swallowed the land, and how the firstborn sons of Egypt fell silent in one night of divine judgment. Then, the moment you've been waiting for, you ask about the sea. His voice slows. "Well, we were trapped," he says. "The sea was before us, Pharaoh behind us." He pauses, but God, and his eyes well up. With one stretch of the hand, he split the sea in two. Walls of water stood on either side, and we walked through on dry ground. You closed your eyes and pictured it. Oh, if you had just been there. The roar of the wind, the trembling earth, the cries of people once bound, now free. You rejoice, not just for survival, but for victory. For the first time, you truly understand what Moses means when he calls Israel his children, loved, led, and liberated. As the new day begins, you step out of your tent and see Moses already at work. The morning sun hasn't yet warmed the earth, but he's there, seated, focused, and surrounded. You watch as lines of people stretch endlessly in front of him, their faces marked by frustration, confusion, and even urgency. To you, Moses is no stranger to hard work, but today he feels different. This is not the labor of lifting stones, pitching tents, or looking after sheep, but this is the burden of judgment. From sunrise to sunset, he listens, one dispute after another, one complaint followed by the next, land boundaries, lost animals, broken promises. He leans forward, asks questions, weighs truth, delivers verdicts. There's no break. There's no pause, only the never-ending stream of problems and one man trying to solve them all. You can't help but wonder, how long can this go on? How can one man carry so much? And then it hits you. Even leaders need help. Moses can't do it alone. So, you pull Moses aside, speaking plainly as a father speaks to a son he loves. You urge him to teach the people that God's decrees and instructions, to show them how to live and what to do, but beyond that, to select capable, trustworthy men, God-fearing leaders who could judge simpler matters, leaving only the most difficult cases for him. This was not about lessening his authority, but it was about multiplying his strength, about ensuring the people that receiving justice and guidance would happen swiftly, about preserving Moses, not only for his family, but for his calling, for the long journey ahead. A leader who stands alone eventually falls alone, but a leader who shares the weight allows the whole community to stand together. He doesn't let pride block his ears or power chain his hands. Instead, Moses does what few leaders dare. He listened, humbled himself, and changed course. Burnout met its match in delegation. He stopped carrying the weight alone and started raising up others. Moses wasn't just leading anymore, he was empowering, and that changed everything. Now the congregation of Israel was beginning to take shape as a nation with order, wisdom, and shared responsibility. A nation learning that leadership is not about a single man standing above all, but about many faithful hands and hearts carrying the mission forward together.
So Moses listened to the voice of his father-in-law, and in all that he had said, Moses chose able men out of all Israel and made them heads over the people, chiefs of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens, and they judged the people at all times. All right, it's good to be back in the studio. Friends, I have a good friend here with us, Israel Ramos.
Hey, what's going on?
Israel is a mentor and a friend of mine, and we've worked together in different ways over the past couple of years. And man, I'm just looking forward to this conversation. What about you, Garrett?
Yeah, I've sat on some different committees with Israel, and that's always been a blessing. And just coming in here and starting this show here, it's we've already had some good smiles and some good laughs, and that's already good. But now we get to share this conversation with our listeners, and I can't wait for that.
Yeah, most people don't know he looks like a serious guy, but he's actually pretty funny.
Yeah, so tell us about what you do, Israel.
I am the director for the Center for Adventist Ministry to Public University Students, also known as Campus, based out of East Lansing, Michigan. And we have a center that operates on the campus of Michigan State University, our largest school in the state of Michigan. And we're there to impact the campus for Christ.
Love that.
Amen. And I got the opportunity to serve with you in campus together, for about 5 years. And that was a great, great time to work with Israel.
Yeah, you guys go way back.
We go way back.
Good times.
Way back.
Love that.
It's actually Israel that actually, he was instrumental in getting me to Michigan because I came as an intern. So anyway, there's so much more that we could say about that. But today's episode, we're talking about constant conflict.
Yeah, and why would you bring Israel in for this topic?
Because this is a conflict resolution session between Israel and I. I'm just kidding.
I'm going to show you conflict. I will show you conflict. Watch. Put it back on, yeah.
For our listeners, he just stopped our music and started it again.
Love it.
So, Israel, so we're in Exodus, for our listeners, we're in Exodus 18, just for orientation. So that way we know where in Scripture we are. And we're talking about Jethro. Mm-hmm. And his interaction with Moses. And yeah, Moses is definitely a hard worker, but there are a number of things that might have stood out to you having read this chapter as a leader. So just starting out, what are some things that came to your attention as you read?
I think in a large way, the chapter to me spoke more about Jethro than it did about Moses. Mm. You know, from the very beginning, chapter 18, verse 1, it says, "Then Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all the good that God had, of all, so not all the good, but all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people." So right here, really, it seems to me as though like the central figure of Exodus 18 is actually Jethro, the father-in-law. Mm. So I think that at least for the first part of the chapter, the focus is on Jethro, not so much Moses. Hmm. So that's the first thing that sticks out to me. So obviously, as I'm reading this passage, what comes to my mind immediately and should come to your minds as well is your father-in-law, you know, my father-in-law. That's what comes to my mind as I'm reading this. I'm like, oh, this is, and I can actually see in my reading of this passage, I can see connections and parallels between my father-in-law and
Moses' father-in-law.
Yeah. Yeah. And the relationship that exists between us and the relationship that exists between Moses and his father-in-law. In a way, the Jethro is not just functioning as his father-in-law, but as his father, as his mentor, you know, in many different ways. One of the first things that sticks out to me is how much wisdom, you know,
Jethro has.
Jethro has. As I was thinking about my father-in-law, when we first bought our house, you know, in Lansing, we got there, we purchased an older home, and my father-in-law, my mother-in-law would come. We inherited 2 acres of blueberries.
Yeah.
And I hate blueberries, and, you know, I that's a whole different story, but I hate blueberries.
Can't stand blueberries. Yeah. All right.
And and he came and he was excited about the house. You know, he's like, Israel, you got 2 acres of blueberries. You got to work this out. You have so many. We have a bunch of apple trees and a pear tree and cherry trees, all these, just like, it was a really, really nice setup. And I remember him saying to me, if you don't start working on this right now, as soon as you get here, this is going to be your best option. Things will only go downhill from here. And he was in such a hurry to make me engage with my property. And I was just thinking, like, man, you know, just everybody take a deep breath. We're going to be fine. Yeah. Relax. Why are you so eager? And now, you know, 15 years later, I'm realizing all the advice that he gave me when I first get there. I'm like, I should have listened to what he said. There's a lot of wisdom there.
Yeah.
And so Jethro, my father-in-law, reminds me of Jethro, the wisdom that he had.
Yeah. I guess that's interesting, right? Because when you think within the story, when we frame it within the context of conflict, not all relationships function that way.
Yeah.
You know, especially in-laws, right? Mm-hmm. Many times you have the unhealthy version. Not the healthy version that you just described.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever come across that.
I have to be very careful because my in-laws listen to this. And so Dave, Chris.
That was a horrible setup. I don't know if you had any.
Yeah, I don't know. You like pointed to me.
No. I did not. That's not a point. That was raising
conflict,
my
conflict
hand.
Conflict is emerging.
That is raising my head for emphasis. But what I'm saying is not pinpointing your personal, but I'm just saying, have you come across, right, in ministry? I mean, you know, we counsel. Mm-hmm. But do we have those types of relationships that we see often on the other side, right? We see the healthy, and I mean, I have in-laws too. Healthy, praise God, praise God, mm-hmm. praise God. But you have the other side where some of those relationships can be unhealthy and quite a lot of conflicts.
Yeah, I think there can be some, I think with parents and children, there can be some codependency on both as those children become adults. Obviously, Moses came to Jethro as an adult, right? Like when they first met, but he didn't have anything going for him, really. I mean, Moses was just a runaway. Mm-hmm. He was on the most wanted list in Egypt. And after a certain amount of time, he became a part of the family. And then, you know, just a reminder to our listeners, when Moses goes back to Egypt, Zipporah goes with him or starts with him.
Mm-hmm. And then,
and then he sends Zipporah back to go be with dad. And so Zipporah's been back in her father's house while Moses is out doing his work,
mm-hmm.
which probably could have added some tension.
Yeah. When I read I think it could have, when I read the text, one of the lessons that kind of immediately jumps out at me is the support system that Jethro provides for Moses.
Yeah.
Which to me, the very first lesson that brings out is that healthy relationships set you up for dealing in a good way with conflict relationships in the future.
Agreed.
Right?
Agreed.
Like without Jethro, without the healthy relation, and this is why I think it's critical for us when we're looking at the first few verses of 18, that we understand Jethro, because Jethro is in many ways the solution to Moses's conflict resolution strategies.
Yeah.
And so I think that the fact that Moses has such a good relationship with Jethro will set him up for success in his work as a minister.
Yeah, that's a powerful point.
Yeah, I mean, and that makes sense. You see Jethro from what we know about him so far, and really, I wish we knew more about Jethro.
Mm-hmm.
We don't find him super prominent in the Exodus story, and this is kind of the spotlight of him. But like you mentioned, Jethro is a priest. He obviously honors God.
Mm-hmm.
Moses has a great respect for him, and so yeah, I think you're right. There's this healthy relationship with Moses that I don't know he really had growing up.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say, too. We don't read a lot about Moses' biological father.
No.
Right? And we could say that Moses' life was full of conflict, right, from the day he was taken to the palace in Egypt. And
certainly.
Then at the age of 40, being an outcast, mm-hmm. you know, after that. So what you're saying about Jethro is just so important, because it speaks to, even after you've experienced unhealthy dynamics, God can somehow provide a healthy version that will help you in your work.
Yeah. And I think what we do know about Jethro, I think there's elements that kind of stick out. Number one, Moses is himself a strong leader. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that it's important for us to remember Moses is a military trained general.
That's right.
You know, I mean, he could, and not just any general, but he's like the general, military trained general of the strongest and largest army in the world. So it's not like Moses is a poor or a weak leader. He's a trained individual. He's got his education at the University of Egypt, top university in the world.
So he's smart.
So he's a smart guy. And actually, if you read in the book of Acts, you know, it says that he excelled in every single thing that course that he took.
Yep.
So Moses is a top-notch individual, which goes to show you that in order for Jethro to be able to impact Moses, to be able to have Moses listen to him, Jethro himself has to be a force to be reckoned with. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, in order for Jethro to earn the respect, have the respect of Moses, Jethro himself has to be a quality guy. And then what we know, you already said, he's a priest. He's got an understanding of priesthood. He offers burnt sacrifices in, what is it, in verse 12. He blesses the Lord in verse 10. He's a spiritual man. He rejoices in the acts of God. This is critical. The rejoicing in the acts of God to me is critical because Moses, he's not jealous of the acts of the way in which God is blessing Moses, right? I mean, think about that. Ourselves, right? Like how easy it is for us when God is blessing someone else for us to be thinking like, hey, God, how come you're not blessing me in the same way?
Mm-hmm.
But Jethro, he doesn't lack confidence. He's not upset that God is blessing Moses clearly in huge ways. None of that affects Jethro. He is happy with Moses' successes, and he is spiritual, and he can identify with Moses because he himself is a priest. This context allows Moses, for the relationship between Moses and Jethro, to be this is like a perfect picture of what a healthy relationship looks like.
And if I can add to that too, I think one of the elements, and this is just stepping outside of chapter 18 for a quick second, we find that the first introduction to Jethro when Moses met him, we find that Jethro hires Moses. So he's a business owner who is leading employees, and Moses becoming one of those employees. So you also see that leadership exemplified in that area too, which, I think that statement of Jethro being a force to reckon with, I mean, definitely you can see that.
I like that observation too, right? Like game recognizes game.
Yeah.
And so Moses looks at Jethro and in essence is saying like, okay, respect.
Yeah.
Like I see you and I am that leader, like Israel mentioned, but yeah, there's some years here that I could learn from.
Yeah. And it's great that, you know, Jethro is on Moses's team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wants to see Moses succeed. He's not out to get Moses. And I think this is critical when we're dealing with conflict resolution as leaders, because the advice that we receive from people as leaders ourselves and as ministers, when you're dealing with hard situations where there doesn't seem to be a clear right or wrong way, right? Because you don't know the future, you don't know the outcome, and you're depending on the advice of someone else. You need to be able to have someone on your team that is wise, but that person needs to be on your side as well, right? Those are the two components, like the components of faith. You know, you need to believe in the power of God and also in the wisdom of God and also in the love of God.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you cannot have faith, right? It's the same thing with the relationship between Jethro and Moses. Moses has to be confident that the advice that Jethro is going to give to him is going to be good advice, but also, or experience, I should say, that it's advice based on experience, but also that Jethro has Moses' best interests in mind so that he can, you know, put his reputation on that advice of his father-in-law. So we can't, I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't think we can overemphasize the fact that healthy relationship, the relationship between Jethro and Moses is the impetus which helps Moses succeed in his ability to handle conflict.
Yeah. Yeah. And if I can point out something as well, two things. The first I would say is when Moses met God at the burning bush and the assignment was announced, you find that Moses goes back to Jethro to get his permission before he goes to Egypt. So that highlights another aspect of that relationship. So he had respect for Jethro.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And just the way that he meets him here in this chapter, right? He gets to Jethro and Moses falls down in submission, right?
Yeah.
And kisses him, which is a beautiful thing. Not to jump ahead a little bit in the narrative, but later on in the story in Exodus, you find that the ones that Moses is supposed to be able to lean on, for instance, Aaron, Aaron lets him down majorly.
Yeah.
Miriam lets him down really bad too. And Jethro is that guy that doesn't.
Yeah. That quiet influence in the background.
Yeah.
And that's what was coming to mind as well. You know, Jethro, other people try to help Moses. They messed up severely. But Jethro was a guy who had Moses' best interest and the wisdom and the experience.
That's amazing.
And he's kind of like that. And we mentioned at the beginning too, like there's not a ton about Jethro in the narrative. And I think that gives so much insight into the type of leadership that Jethro had with Moses. Because Moses was the leader of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
But Jethro didn't really need, he was comfortable leading from second chair, right? Like taking that step back in the background and giving Moses this advice. Wasn't flashy, but Moses needed Jethro. Mm-hmm. And Jethro's kind of in the shadows, and he prefers it that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Now, can we talk about this aspect in 18? The fact that Jethro brings Moses' wife and kids to meet Moses, right? What does that say about his role, right? And I know we're talking about leader and father-in-law here, but how does this piece fit in, right? Like, we don't see... Well, I guess I'll let you answer that, Israel. How does this piece fit in, the fact that Jethro would bring Moses' family back to him?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not really sure. I haven't thought about that a lot. I think what immediately comes to my mind is that there's no conclusive feedback on whether what I'm saying is true or not, but maybe there are elements in, you know, Moses could be focused on his work so much so that he's neglecting his family, or... he's missed, you know, I mean, clearly there are times when Moses forgets about home issues that need to be resolved, right? Mm-hmm. Taken care of. And so he's got that history. I'm guessing that maybe perhaps we don't know if Moses called for his family. That could have happened. But what we do see from here is the fact that Jethro is aware of the family dynamics and their importance beyond work and beyond ministry. And the family dynamics are part of the ministry that God calls us to. And so he's at the very least aware of that, and at best helping Moses understand this importance.
Mm. What came to your mind, Jermaine, in bringing this up?
Well, for me, I just, again, within the chair of a mentor, like putting Jethro in that seat, I think it announces, like you were saying there, Israel, the fact that you can tell that at least he had the sense of mind to say, Moses, I don't want you to miss this piece, right? I want to make sure that ministry includes your family, right? And not isolation from it. So like Jethro could have just gone and visited Moses and come back, right? Mm-hmm. But this is a very deliberate act to bring the family in. And like you said, we don't know if Moses had called to get the family over, but either way, you do see him acting this way. Like he took Zipporah. That's the word the Bible uses there. Like, and brought her and the kids.
Yeah. And there's no, at least from we can tell in the text, there doesn't seem to be any tension or awkwardness between Jethro and Moses.
Exactly.
Like, man, if I got so busy at work that I sent my wife and kids home to live with my father and mother-in-law for a while. And by the way, when they did left, my wife said, "You bloody person!" Right? Remember,
Zipporah
and Moses
kind
of left tense.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that Zipporah probably went back a little bit frazzled and, you know, just struggling. And Jethro here doesn't show any
anger
or resentment for that.
Mm-hmm. Verse 6 says, "And he said unto Moses, Jethro, I thy father-in-law Jethro am come unto thee, and thy wife and her two sons with her." So it does seem to indicate that Jethro was the one that takes initiative, that Moses is not calling for his family, but Jethro is the one that says, "Hey, I'm here to visit you, and I brought your wife and your two sons." So I think these things are important. You know, the more I read about this, I'm by no means a Moses, you know what I'm saying? Or trying to compare myself to he's the greatest leader outside of Jesus, probably in all of Scripture.
Yeah.
But the more I read this passage, the more I can see, you know, the blessing of having someone of more experience and the stability that they bring to my ministry without even having a direct impact on my ministry. You know, so many things that come to mind, you know, when my father-in-law comes and says, you know what? It's great that you're working hard, you're trying to do this and you're trying to do that, but don't forget, at the end of the day, when you come home, it doesn't alleviate the fact that you have a responsibility at home too. And all these little gentle reminders that come with, they're small comments that come with years and decades of experience of the journey that you're on. You think that you think you're doing something special,
yeah.
But many, many men have gone through this. And we have a lot of wisdom to share with you and how we've grown from our mistakes. So I see that in Jethro's life and his advice to Moses.
Mm.
There's something now, I think, that emerges in the narrative. So you have this relationship that is strong. And I think the strength of that relationship is a necessary context for verse 14. So when we hit verse 14, Jethro comes, he speaks with Moses, he tells Moses, hey, I'm bringing your wife, your kids with you. We have a little bit of insight into the lives of the kids and their names, the meanings of their names. Now they're checking how the other person's doing, their welfare. Moses begins to talk to Jethro about what the Lord has done. Jethro rejoices with Moses, strengthening, you know, the narrative strengthens that relationship that exists. And then the next day, Moses goes into work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Jethro has a glimpse of that. And verse 14 picks up there. And when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did to the people, he said, what is this thing that thou doest to the people? Why sittest thou alone and all the people stand by thee from morning unto evening? You know, under any circumstances, under most circumstances, this is hard stuff to hear.
Yeah,
it is.
So here you would think this is actually going to be the initiation of conflict between Moses and Jethro,
mm-hmm.
right? And so the question is, why isn't there conflict there? That's kind of what got me thinking about Jethro, because I guarantee you that if someone comes to me and I'm working day and night,
morning till evening, yeah,
doing my best to serve the Lord, knowing that I am called, Moses knows that he is called to deliver Israel.
Absolutely.
He knows that the hand of God is upon him. He's got a past to rely on. Like, you know, Moses, you know, if you're a dumb version of Moses, Jethro, you know what I'm saying? Hey, can I call you Jay? You know, did you part the Red Sea? Right? You know, has God used you the way he's used me?
Yeah.
Did God speak to you through the burning bush?
Yeah.
You know, bro, right? So
totally.
This does not happen. And I think that the reason why that does not happen, outside of the fact that Moses is a much better person than I am, is there is this strong relationship that allows for this kind of conversation to take place. That, yeah, God is using you, but hey, you got to look.
There are some inefficiencies here.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I was going to say, it's interesting that you mentioned that because, yeah, the narrative kind of strengthens the relationship before we get to the conflict.
Yeah.
Right? And I just love the fact that it does that. It eases us right in. So there's a reunion. There's a rejoicing. Jethro, it paints the picture that he's clearly not jealous of Moses. There's no reason for him to be viewed as a threat.
Mm-hmm.
But it also illustrates Moses' humility and maturity in that when Moses meets Jethro, he is not standing up tall. He is bowing down and giving deference to Jethro, who's coming in with his family. So I think that's important. I think it takes two things to make that work. Well, it has to be maturity on the part of the individual whose God is leading, and also maturity on the part of the person who's offering the counsel, right?
Yeah.
And having that level of maturity to strengthen that relationship. And it's interesting, right? What you said, what came to my mind is the manifestation towards Moses that God gave, right? The burning bush, like these are monumental things that have never happened in the biblical account, right? Moses could have literally used any one of these to say, look, you do not have a right to speak to me.
Mm-hmm. the resume this guy had. One thing in Moses' resume up to this point, it's a life achievement award for anybody else.
The climax.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, just one of them. The guy's got like five up to this
yeah,
point.
Yeah. Know? Just one. Yeah.
I was going to say the same thing too, right? Yeah. Like the intentionality of Jethro to be like, God is doing amazing things and he's doing those things through you, right? Like he recognizes that in Moses before this potential conflict could mm-hmm. come up. I'm curious if he knew that was going to come up or not, because he hasn't seen Moses at work yet, mm-hmm. but he does give thanksgiving with Moses before this mm-hmm. potential conflict could happen. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he recognizes that. Mm-hmm. He never says, you're great, Moses. He says, the Lord is good.
Mm-hmm. So I think that brings up another important point too, because sometimes, right, the loathing, not loathing, but the gloating sometimes that comes from relatives over your successes mm-hmm. as a child, you know, like, oh, I'm related to the guy that parted the sea. You know, like mm-hmm. Jethro was not blinded by the limelight of Moses' resume to the point where he's unwilling to speak the truth mm-hmm. to him, which was often something that comes up too. I wondered if like, how would this look in our modern context?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, when you have an experience with God and you've seen God work in your life, there's nothing small about the way he works in your life. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like the fact that we're alive, the fact that, you know, we experience relative success in our ministries, all of these are given to us as indicators that God is like, I'm with you. Just in the very same way that I am with Moses. Now, Moses can part the Red Sea, and you might not ever have that experience, but it doesn't change the fact that I'm with you in the same exact way. And so I get the impression from Jethro, the fact that he rejoicing is an immediate response. These are all acts of character.
Uh-huh.
You know, cannot hide character.
That's right.
Like it's a natural response for him to rejoice. That's because that's the kind of person he is. It's natural for him to offer a sacrifice. That's the kind of person he is. It's natural for him to bring the wife and the kids to Moses. That's the kind of person he is. Why? Because he is a priest. He has been in the presence of God throughout his work and ministry.
Got it.
And so when he sees the acts of Moses, he says, actually, this is the same thing, just different, right? God is with me the way he's with Moses. It's just a different manifestation of the same God, the same power, the same everything. So because of this, Jethro has the depth of experience and character to not be wowed in a significant way by the way in which Moses is being used, because he knows it's the same God.
Yeah, yeah. It's the same calling, just different events, right? And, you know, Jethro also, I mean, if Moses had said, like we had mentioned, who parted the Red Sea, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Jethro could have responded with, well, who took you in?
And where does it end? Where does it end? Yeah.
Yeah, but I like what you said. Like, this is the character of somebody that is submitted to God and has so much experience that Moses can learn from. And the humility of Moses to take that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think then we could maybe just highlight this one point then for our listeners. I think if I hear you right, what you're saying is dealing with conflict takes character.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, I think you cannot, every act is a revelation of character, right? The book Education tells us that. Mm-hmm. And right here, you have a situation where under most human perspectives would create a conflict, but it doesn't. And that has to do with simply the character of Jethro and the relationship that has emerged between those two characters. I'm inclined to think that Jethro did not know, you know,
what Moses' schedule looked like,
what's going to happen the next day.
Agreed.
So it shows you Jethro is not, he's not interested. He's not like, you know, how we have modern day now. All right, if I'm going to say something negative to somebody, let me couch it with positive, negative, positive.
The sandwich method.
Yeah, yep, he's not, you know, he's not reading a John Maxwell book. Like, this brother is, he's genuinely happy, doesn't need to say anything negative, but it just so happens the next day something negative comes on. So I think that the relationship here is critical, because this is what it shows us the lesson that under the right circumstances, with the right investment in the relationship, and with the right character among the two individuals, conflict is not necessary.
Yeah, I wonder too if in the sharing that Moses had with Jethro in his tent, if they covered also the conflicts that Moses experienced with the children of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because that was daily. The complaints, the grumblings, like, and this could be something that Moses, like, again, going back to the character thing, Moses could have responded with that. Like, mm-hmm. you have no idea what I've been through.
Yeah.
Like, this has not been easy. Like, this is the only way I've figured out how to make this work. Like, mm-hmm. you have no idea. But yeah, that's not his response.
Yeah, and notice too that Jethro isn't just rejoicing and having these conversations with Moses, but there in verse 12, he brings in all the elders too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they have this conversation, not just with Moses, but Aaron is invited. The elders are invited. The whole team is invited to experience this. And you wonder if those conversations happened. Like, we're glad that you're here, but you should have seen us a few weeks ago when
yeah.
we couldn't drink any water because there wasn't anything.
Mm-hmm. There's a phrase there in 12. It ends with these words, right? It says to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I think this highlights that vertical relationship, right? Even though they're having these discussions, these dialogues, at the center of it all is they're doing this in the presence of God.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if, like, when we deal with conflicts, if we were to imagine ourselves in the presence of God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the impact that would have in our lives. I mean, it, you know, so many times actually conflicts arise because we're not aware of
God's presence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, like, think about the fights, the conflicts we have, you know, with our spouses, right? You're thinking, like, God, if you were here telling this, you know, telling my wife to behave, right?
This would not have happened.
Telling her that I'm right. We would not be having this situation right now. So we're not aware of the presence of God.
Right.
So we're like, all right, I'm going to have to teach my wife a lesson here. And then, you know, that's why we have conflicts.
Yeah.
And anytime there's a conflict is, I think, because we're unaware of the presence of God.
Yeah, that's a powerful point. Going back to Adam and Eve, even, right? The fact that they're hiding
mm-hmm.
from the presence of God, leading mm-hmm. to that marital conflict
between them. Yeah,
between the two of them. Like, yeah that's a very good point.
Yeah.
It's like when we are not aware of God's presence, it leads to the mm-hmm. breakdown of relationships. Yeah.
Because, you know, just a few moments before with Adam and Eve, the man's willing to die for her. Like, I cannot live without
bone
you.
Bone of my bones.
Yeah. And then, you know, she eats the fruit, and then Adam's like, man, if she's gonna die, I'm gonna die. You know. And so, because, you know, she was tricked to eating the fruit, but he ate the fruit on purpose. And so a few verses before, Adam's willing to die with Eve. They're not aware of the presence of God. All of a sudden, you know, hey, you know, there's conflict.
Yeah.
This girl messed me up, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So
she did it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think the imbalance here of the relationships has to do with our understanding of where God is and what he should be in our relationships.
Yeah, I think a prime example of that is Peter, right? So Peter tells Jesus, hey man, if you get dragged to the cross, I'm going with you.
Mm-hmm. Like,
you're not doing that alone. And then what happens?
A few chapters
later, he's cursing the name of Jesus
mm-hmm.
when conflict arises and he's in danger. Same situation.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, there might be constant conflict, but we need to be aware of where God is.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's an important thing I'm going to take away from this conversation. Okay, let's jump down then to verse 15.
Well, if we can do, there's some in verse 14 that really, I think we could unpack a little bit.
Yeah, sure, let's do it.
All right. So here in verse 14, Moses' father-in-law, he sees, look at the language that is used here. What he saw all that he did to the people, right? It says he's all that he did to the people. And then he says, what is this thing that you're doing to the people? I think Jethro is saying, like, hey, the way you're behaving is affecting, because we normally think about, hey, you're wearing out. You're wearing out, Moses. You're going to wear out. You're not going to, you know, this is a marathon, not a sprint, right? But he's actually saying, like, your style of leadership, this is, man, you're hurting the people.
You're
like,
messing the people up.
You're messing the people up. And so it's mentioned twice, the thing that you're doing to the people. And then he says, why are you sitting alone? Sitting alone is something that you're doing not to yourself,
but to the people.
But to the people.
Right.
And
got to unpack that.
Yeah,
I'm waiting.
So I think that in this situation, what Jethro's trying to say is, you know, it's easy for us, you know, to think about the conflicts that we're dealing, because Moses is dealing with the conflict situation. And the conflict is that the people are just continuing to come to him over and over and over and over again. And he is blaming the people. He thinks the people are doing this to him.
Yep.
The reason why I'm sitting here day and night is because these people, they're doing this to me. And Jethro says, actually, no.
You're doing
this to the people. You're creating an environment where you've conditioned the people to do this, and now you have this victim mentality that this is what is being done to you, right? Yeah. And so Jethro is kind of opening Moses' eyes to see the problem is not the people.
It's you.
You're the problem, and you are causing problems to the people. The people are not causing problems to you. And what does this teach us about conflict? What it teaches me about conflict is that in many situations, I'm the source of the conflict, and it's easy for me to blame other people for the source of the conflict,
sure.
Right? So it's like, I think my point is right, and because my point is right, this person's not accepting my perspective, they are doing this to me. Whereas if I take the opposite perspective, I am doing something, I am the source, I am the role that I'm playing in the conflict, it would help in many situations, right, to resolve the conflict. And so I think that it teaches us in leadership to think about, even if we think we're right in the situation, or even if there is something on our end that is true or something that is justified, maybe it's good for us to stop for a while and to ask ourselves a question, what are we doing to the people? You know, what am I doing to my brother? What am I doing to my sister? What am I doing to my wife, my spouse? What is my role in this conflict, and how can I change my role to help reverse the problem rather than asking somebody, can you deal with the people, right?
I think what you're describing is so different than our modern day type of leadership,
mm-hmm.
right? Because leadership, the way that we structure it is often, we see it as, you know, the leader at the top, right? It's always within the framework. Like when you think about just influencers, social media influencers, like they're the center of everything,
yeah.
right? It's the people that, and if something happens to them, it's the people that, mm-hmm. it's like, this is what the people did to me. Like the people got me here. The people are going to make sure that I stay where I'm at. And yeah, that's very, what you're describing is very antithetical to our current model of leadership. And I wonder, how do we get out of that trend,
mm-hmm.
right? How do we step away from that insular victim mindset when things go wrong, starting to think, well, the people did this to me, instead of mm-hmm. taking responsibility ourselves as leaders and saying, no, actually, it's the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
I did this,
yeah.
you know, mm-hmm. for a pastor, I did this to the church, not the church did this to me. Right. For a young person leading on a college campus, it's like my group did this to me, and not taking personal responsibility. I see less and less of that in our modern day culture. And I don't know how to reconcile that with the story we're reading here.
Mm-hmm.
You see yeah. what I'm saying?
I get it. I think it's interesting, too, to remember the meta narrative of what's happening here in Exodus. And we've gone through this in the last few episodes, and we'll continue to do this. But God is trying to create a nation. Right?
A new way.
A new nation, a holy nation, a new way. And up until this point, God has called them a congregation, but they're still acting like institutionalized slaves, right? And this commentator, I really like it. It's the ESV commentary. It mentions that the children of Israel are acting like slaves would act back in Egypt. They're going to Pharaoh to answer all of their
problems.
That's
what I was thinking.
And Moses is acting like a
Pharaoh. Like a Pharaoh, yeah.
Without knowing it, maybe himself. Mm-hmm. He is setting himself up as that guy. Mm-hmm. And the children of Israel naturally respond to that because 400 years of institutionalism, that's just how they respond. Of course, we'll go to the guy because he's the guy.
Yeah,
that's what we do.
Yeah.
And it robs them of them having their own conflict resolution too, like we'd been mentioning.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I could see too from Moses' perspective, right? Because 40 years of education under, you know, Egypt, and he excelled in that space. So it could be that the model of leadership, maybe he's coming out of that, but he's not fully there yet.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
There are a lot of maybes there, but I think, yeah, like you said, Israel, that's a very powerful point to consider the fact that, yeah, he's having to rethink.
Mm-hmm.
And Jethro becomes the catalyst right. for this rethinking,
mm-hmm.
which is just very powerful of,
yeah.
you know, in terms of how God is working this out.
And you were mentioning at the center of the problem is self-centeredness.
Yeah.
Right. Whether I'm not saying Moses is a self-centered guy, but he's working under a self-centered model.
That's right.
As you were mentioning with Pharaoh and so forth. So, because the solution is set people up, like empower other people, delegate what you're doing. In other words, move things away from yourself. You know, if you can start kind of imagining what kind of a scenario Moses is dealing with, it says here, you know, in verse 14, you're sitting by yourself alone and all the people standing by you from morning to evening. So it's like Jethro was saying, you want to know what's worse than sitting down where you're sitting and being worn out by listening to all these problems?
It's standing
for your problem to be heard by you all night long, like all day into the evening. Can you imagine the last person to be heard by you? This person has stood in line all day. It's like when you go to Disneyland, you know, and you're like a 10-second ride, but you're standing there all day. You're like, man, it's not worth it.
Yeah.
This thing is not worth it. And you're done with the whole experience, and you're like, why did I spend my money to come here, right? I mean, this is like the experience of these people. They're sitting here all day long into the evening time, or they're getting up early in the morning to be first in line, standing all day long just to be heard by Moses, because you're not, you know, because this is the model that you've created for your, by the time you get to the front, like if you're at the end, by the time you get to the front, you're getting more and more upset.
Oh yeah.
By the time you get, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. You're brewing, like, you know, you're playing that conversation in your mind over and over and over again. Like, yeah, I had this thing with Garrett and Jermaine and, you know, we got, and man, they shouldn't have, you know, and he always does this. He always does this thing, man. Right. And then he did it that time. He didn't just do it to me. He did it to the other person. And by the time I get to Moses,
that pent-up frustration is coming out. I'm
ready to unload. So this is what Jethro was saying. Like, this is what you're doing to the people. You not empowering others creates more conflict. You focusing as the center, the bottleneck of resolution, only increases the tension. In order to release, in order to deal with conflict resolution, there needs to diffuse that. Diffusion takes place by removing ourselves from the center of the picture, right?
Wow.
Self-centeredness needs to get eliminated in order for us to deal with conflict in a healthy way. It's kind of what I learned from this text.
And I don't like that.
I
agree with you, but I don't like that. Like, it's really uncomfortable to recognize and to self-reflect enough and realize that the common denominator of all the conflict, the bad conflict that I have had in my life, whether it's personally, whether it's at church, the common denominator is always me.
Mm-hmm. It is with all of us.
It's hard.
And you think about it too on the other side, right? Going back to the idea of self-centeredness, right? Usually leaders like being the person to make the decision, right? I mean, you want everybody to come to you. Right. In some sense, if we were to narrow it down
carnally,
to just a selfish human nature, right? That's what you want. You want to be the guy, right? Or the girl, right? However you frame it. And yeah, it's interesting. Again, like this, what we're talking about is so pivotal here because God is trying to break that up, right? It can't be about you, right? Like there's no other option for things to go forward rather than, there's no other option than diffusing.
Yeah.
Right. There's no other option that will make this a functional congregation. And I love that word, functional congregation, because I think there are many dysfunctional churches because of dysfunctional leaders who have this model.
But, you know, it, just speaking practically here, when you're trying to empower other leaders around you, that's work.
Yeah.
Like it's hard because you have to trust them and you also have to recognize that when they mess up, then it's all going to fall back on you too. So might as well just do it all myself, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's probably what Moses thought.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, we're calling Garrett Moses from now on.
No, I mean, it's just work, man. Yeah. Like trying to empower people that you know are going to mess up. Like, that's just...
Ugh. Yeah.
Well, you could say he tried before with Aaron.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Right? I mean, Aaron was empowered to take on responsibilities and that ended up in a golden calf.
Yeah.
Right. So you could also raise that argument. Like Moses could have responded like, hey man, the last time I tried this.
Well, that hasn't happened yet. The golden calf hasn't happened yet.
Oh yeah, yeah, you're right. Yeah. I'm thinking ahead. Yeah.
But it's going to.
But the point is still there. Like, you know, it is because Moses delegated that he got himself into trouble, you know, at the end of the day. And what that tells us is that, you know, just because you're going to deal with hardship and just because people make mistakes does not change the fact that God's plan for self-centeredness leadership is the best way to resolve conflict, you know, because anytime you look at this, this model, by the way, of removing self from the center, it's across the field everywhere you look in scripture, right? From the creation story, God wants to create the world. He's like, you know what? Let's create the world. Jesus, you do it. God could have created the world himself. He allows Jesus to do it. Jesus says, okay, I'm going to create the world. But when Jesus creates everything, what does he write in everything? God is love. Every cell, every blade of grass, every, ion, negative or positive ion in the air has the
I knew that was coming.
Has a signature of God's love. Should we break for an advertisement on air purifiers?
No, I think we're good.
Okay, stick to the topic. Let's not create conflict. So in everything that God does, there is this element of removing of self. Right.
Well, can you go a step further, though, with Jesus? Because when the world was made, Adam was given the garden to tend and keep it. Right?
Yes,
so it's like,
right,
this is creation. So then he hands it over further. So, yeah. So you're right. So it continues down the line. Yeah. Right. And Adam and Eve were to have children. And the same went down the line.
Yeah.
So, yeah, God operates through the fusion.
Yeah. And regardless of what the consequences are,
He still,
because Adam and Eve are going to fall, doesn't change the fact that God is going to empower them. Right. The gospel is, the commission is given to us.
12,
We're going to mess up. Yeah. Angels could do a perfect work. No, it's given to us. And God deals with the consequences of that, right? But if we don't follow God's method, then not only is Moses, he says, this is a thing that you're doing to you. You're going to weary yourself and the people.
Which to me, I mean, that's fascinating about God, right? That's just a powerful thought. The fact that God has full knowledge, but still has full trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Because we don't trust because of what we know about people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we know ourselves, right? And we know that we're inconsistent too, if we're honest. And on a personal note, Israel, and practically too, like, and I don't know how you're going to answer this, but so like, those of you that are listening to this podcast, Israel was the founder of GYC, which has been a profound impact on my life, right?
Likewise.
And GYC started off pretty small, right? Mm-hmm. A few hundred people coming for a youth convention. And then it grew into a movement of thousands of young people. And there came a point in GYC's history where you decided to pass on the leadership of that movement to younger, more inexperienced people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been going on for a while now. And how, and I don't know if any of the young people that you have empowered have let you down. I'm sure there have been some that have. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that as a leader, to like take something that has your DNA on it and it's something that you love and you've poured so much time into, and then you're just like, okay, I'm going to take this and I'm going to give it to the next generation. Like how do you personally work through something like that?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting how the outside people view GYC versus how I viewed GYC from my standpoint.
Sure.
I think I can relate to Jethro's experience in terms of my experience with GYC. I sense the presence of God.
Amen.
And for me, I've always known, and in the back of my head, I've always known what, and I remind myself of what my experience has been. You know, I remember there's clear moments in my life, whether it's through GYC or through other things, where I feel like God is doing something great in my life, where my prayer is like, God, do not remove the veil that blocks me from the way the world sees me, right? Because I know, like, I have a past.
Sure.
You know, I know I have insecurities. I know I have very, very clear weaknesses.
Yeah.
The people closest to me would not hesitate to be able to identify them, right? My kids, my wife, they know that the broken man that I am.
Yeah.
And if all of these things of who I really am, my past, my family, whatever it is, if this was to be exposed, the damage that would cause, the embarrassment that would cause to me, my family, and the work, it's a miracle of God and his grace that God uses people to do this, right? And so I always tell, whenever we deal with pastors and we're training pastors, one of the first lessons I teach is what qualifies you to ministry is a reminder of who you are. The moment you forget who you are, you're disqualified from ministry. Yeah. Because you're listening, right? Like as a pastor, how many people have you listened to their story? You know, my husband is beating me.
Yeah.
My wife cheated on me. My dad and my mom are cheating on each other, or they're drinking alcohol and they're serving in church leadership. All of these different things. You're listening to the stories of other people. And if you for a moment forget who you are, you start to judge them.
Oh, yeah.
That's how,
right.
You know,
that's right.
But it is it is in remembering who you are that you do not pass judgment, that you realize were it not for the grace of God, I would be that and worse, right?
Yeah.
And so remembering who we are and God's grace and goodness to us allows us to let go, allows us to let go of the need to be right, the need to be successful, the need to be great, the need to be at the center. All of these things are the result of our own insecurities. The moment we recognize God has been good to us, we can let go, right? We can let go. And when people, disappointment is not as big of an issue as pain, right? When someone deliberately tries to hurt you,
sure,
then that's a lot different because we can deal with a person makes a mistake. You remember, I made a mistake. I've made many mistakes, but it is when people intentionally try to hurt you that you know, there's real damage that is caused, I could say.
I love that. So when you forget who you really are without Jesus, then you're kind of disqualified from ministry and from leadership.
Yeah.
And I think that applies so much to this story, right? Moses is hearing those things, not just a few times a week, but moment by moment, every single day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could see how it'd be very easy for Moses to forget.
Mm-hmm. If anyone could have a big head.
Would
be Moses. I would say to add to that what Israel is saying too. I mean, I've personally experienced it having done the campus residency program, so I'll put an ad for that there. But I think one of the lessons that I remember hearing from you is the thought that failure is an option,
mm-hmm.
right? Like failure is never eliminated when someone is empowered. And right. I felt that, you know, mm-hmm. like working with you, like I often felt like, I mean, I felt there are some days where, man, I'm like, yeah, that was a really bad decision.
Yeah.
And you make choices and you're like, man, I wonder if this is going to be, if this is going to be approved, right, by someone that you look up to. But yeah, to hear that, yeah, failure is an option, which again, it eases a lot of that tension. It's like what I want you to do here is even in the presence of failure, I don't want you to forget, well, number one, who you are, but don't forget that you should try,
mm-hmm.
right? And keep trying.
Yeah.
Right. Which again is very empowering here. Like, and I love the fact that Jethro doesn't solve the problem for Moses; he identifies it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And he gives pointers, but he's not appointing people. You know, to like, okay, Moses, I brought up a solution. Here's what I have in mind. Here are 10 guys that are already selected. Right. We already have a voting system in place.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's all solved for you. But again, even Moses in this conversation is empowered to do something.
Yeah. And there is that risk factor, like you mentioned, like when you're teaching your child to walk, you got to let go of their hand at some point.
Mm-hmm.
You got to take off the training wheels at some point. Right. And allow them to fall and bust up their knees
mm-hmm. yeah.
and experience that.
Yeah.
And that's hard to do as a parent.
Mm-hmm. And I think that at the foundation of all of these things, what emerges is in order to deal with these difficulties, you need a strong relationship with the people that you're dealing with.
Mm.
And at the center of these core relationships, in order to have strong relationships, you need people of character.
Mm.
And how do you build people of character? People of character are built by having people that recognize God's experience intersecting in their lives, right? The presence of God in their lives. So I think you can kind of break that down. It is the presence of God in our lives that develop in us characters of integrity. It is the development of relationships with people of integrity that provide a context for us to be able to go out into the world and to deal with the conflicts that will arise because we're human being and we make mistakes. And so at the center of all of this, it cannot be us. It has to be God in us in order for us to be able to succeed in dealing with conflicts in our lives.
Amen to that.
Can we take a look at verse 18 and 19? I know we're kind of jumping around. We're actually running out of time. But verse 18, Jethro says to Moses, "Thou wilt surely wear away both thou and this people that is with thee, for the thing is too heavy for you. Thou art not able to perform it thyself alone." Right? Again, that idea of him having regard for Moses, but also the people, mm-hmm. right? And sometimes when you read it, you think, right, he doesn't want Moses to burn out, but he's also thinking about the people that mm-hmm. will burn out too.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not just Moses burning out. Did you have any thought there, Israel, on 18 or Garrett?
Yeah, I love the part where it says, this thing is too heavy for you. And the idea that we ourselves are pharaohs or saviors is a responsibility that is too big for anyone to carry.
That's deep.
Ministry is too hard for any one person. And that's why I think it's critical for us to be people of delegation. The more the work is delegated, the more it's spread out, the less conflict will arise. And we need to be preemptive in this. You know, this is a preemptive, preventative measure. As soon as we receive power, power is given to us for us to diffuse. If we hold on to that power and we become pharaohs and we become we create self-centered environments and models, yeah. then it will naturally result in conflict. Why? Because this thing is too heavy for us, right? God gives us burdens that are too heavy for us to be able to disperse influence and power and responsibility. The moment we hold on to it, we're carrying too much weight that we will not be able to carry. And it is silly for us to think, I will put my will in, my will alone will carry this. Mm. That's Moses' experience up to this point. Yeah. My will alone is carrying this. And Jethro comes and says, no. You think you're only damaging yourself, but you're actually hurting the work. And the idea that we can be the saviors of the world, it's not just going to hurt ourselves, but the people we love the most as well, our families, the people that work with us, et cetera.
Yeah.
Wow.
This might be a little bit of a nerdy moment here, but this is how I'm making sense of it in my brain. You know, the difference between a king or a pharaoh and a president is very different. You know, when we think of the word president, we think of like the man, right? Or the woman that's the president of whatever it might be. But like United States, for instance. But, you know, the word president is broken down in its most elementary form as presiding mm-hmm. for the people, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Presiding for the people. So it's your responsibility as the presider of the people to set your own checks and balances, mm-hmm. right? Mm. And that is supposed to be the responsibility of the president of this country. And I'm sure other organizations that elect presidents as well in a process, because this is the person that we have elected to preside for us, but also set up those checks and balances. And Moses here, yeah, he's beginning that system, or encouraged to begin that system of, okay, yes, you're presiding for the people. We're not taking that away from you, but there's got to be some checks and balances in the form of other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can we jump down to verse 19? He says, "Hearken now unto my voice. I will give thee counsel, and God shall be with thee. Be thou for the people to Godward, that thou mayest bring the causes unto God. And thou," he says, going on, "shalt teach them ordinances and laws, and shalt show them the way wherein they must walk, and the work that they must do. Moreover, thou shalt provide out of all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands and rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties and rulers of tens."
Mm-hmm. Something that struck me here is the fact that whether you're ruling 10, ruling 100, ruling 50, or ruling 1,000, you actually have the same exact qualification.
Mm.
You know, you fear God, and you hate covetousness. These were the qualifications for the individual. So actually, your assignment did not so much depend on your qualification. It just, you needed the same qualification for all.
For any assignment mm-hmm. in God's work.
Yeah. And it shows you that the person who oversees 50 and the person who oversees 1,000 is actually the same exact kind of person. It's just different responsibilities. The person who splits the Red Sea and the person who offers the burnt sacrifice, it's the same type of person, just different responsibilities. The more we recognize that the call is the qualification and that the call comes to the person with character, the more we would be willing to let go of the things, that the power that we so tightly grip onto, and the less problems and conflicts would arise. That's what struck me there with that.
No, I agree with you. I think it's a very good thing for us to remember that. I like what you said, that the call is the qualification. I love that line. I think it's easy for us to play that comparison game of, well, God has only given me the 10, and he's given my brother over here 1,000, and our relationship with God is the same. Why does it feel like God favors him over me, right? And, of course, that's a dangerous thought in and of itself.
Yeah.
But God gives us what we need. And it, for me, my need might be you can handle 10. Not because you can't handle more, but because you can't handle that kind of position.
Well, I think again, it also shows the flawed view of favor, right? Mm-hmm. Because in this story, and going back to what Israel was saying earlier, is the favor is not in the responsibility, it's in the call.
Right.
Like, that's where God shows his favor. Like, God is, the very fact that he called us is a demonstration of his goodness.
And a miracle. Right?
And it doesn't matter what the responsibility is. Like, I mean, we should, like, just be grateful for the call. Mm-hmm.
Totally.
You know? And again, like that having those traits of character, which again is just brilliant for Jethro to see the necessity of, irregardless of the responsibility you bear, you still need character at the end of the day to carry it out.
Yeah.
So as we wrap things up, what are some key takeaways for our audience?
For me, what strikes me the most from our conversation has been the need to eliminate self from the picture. The more I do this, the better I will deal with conflicts and the less conflicts I will be a part of.
Garrett?
Yeah, Moses was humble enough to listen, not just listen to God, but listen to someone that, like we mentioned, may have had less on his resume by terms of miraculous things, but recognized that God was sending him for a purpose.
Yeah, and for me, it takes character to deal with conflict. I mean... Sometimes we diminish the role of that, and we narrow things down to strategies and concepts and methods. But at the end of the day, character is what wins the day.
It's interesting too, and I know we're wrapping up, but the last verse of this chapter, Jethro is like, "All right, see ya."
He's gone again.
He leaves. Like he trusts Moses is going to do what's right, and he doesn't hover. He takes off.
Well, all right, everybody. That's a wrap. Thank you so much for listening to the Godding Podcast. Again, I'm Jermaine.
I'm Garrett. Thanks for coming, Israel.
Hey, my pleasure.